From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Daly City.
Potrero Hill.
Glen Park.
South Beach.
I live in Bernal Heights.
Coming up, we're headed to the Oakland Zoo to meet one of our state's most endangered birds.
And then you see this thing that makes this big shadow come over, and you point, and it's like, oh, that's a condor. And there's just nothing like it.
Saving California's condors. Then we visit a hospital for animals who are supposed to be swimming.
Pretty soon you hear about sea lions ending up on highways in the Central Valley. We see a sea lion out on I-80.
And we'll hear from you with your responses to a controversial story we aired about the newly striped lanes in Golden Gate Park.
I wish they would go back to the old way. Really hard not to heat people now.
What we make of our environment, that's today on Cross Currents. Stay with us. One of the biggest environmental stories in the Bay right now is that of the Drake's Bay Oyster Company. It's an oyster farm in the Point Reyes National Seashore that's becoming the center of a nationwide debate over what it means to preserve wilderness. After the National Seashore was created in 1962, the oyster farm got a long-term lease to operate on the park land. That lease expired at the end of last year, and Interior Secretary Ken Salazar refused to renew it. Days after the announcement, Drake's Bay Oyster Company owner Kevin Lunny said news of the decision had devastated the local community.
This is a place of excitement and fun and people laughing and coming out to these picnic tables and enjoying themselves. And since that decision, people have been driving in, getting out of their cars in tears, hugging. I've been hugged by dozens and dozens of people that I don't even know. It's almost like a death in a family is what it feels like.
The Lunnies are fighting the order on the grounds that Congress intended the lease to be renewable and that the farm is an integral part of the regional economy. They took their case to court last week, asking a federal judge for an injunction that would keep the farm open during litigation. The courtroom was packed, both with supporters of the oyster farm and opponents, including Neil Desai of the National Parks Conservation Association.
This isn't their private property. They're not entitled to a new permit. This is our land. This is all of the listeners here. This is our land. We are taxpayers. We own this property. And the direction for this place is to become a fully protected marine wilderness, the only one in the continental U.S.
It's now up to a judge to decide whether the oyster farm can continue to operate. If she rules against the farm, it'll close its doors at the end of next month. We'll have more on this story on Cross Currents in the coming weeks. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. It's a challenge to balance human development on the one hand with the preservation of species on the other. This is the sound of the California condor, a severely endangered bird and one of the oldest and largest in North America. The process of trying to protect and now regenerate the condor population began in the early 1900s. Since then, government agencies have spent $20 million on the conservation effort, making it the most expensive in U.S. history. The condor has become a national symbol of the movement to protect endangered animals. It's the first species listed on the Endangered Animals Act of 1973, and it tends to inspire dramatic statements, like this one from journalist John Nielsen, as read by KALW's Seth Samuel.
The California condor is the Elvis Presley of endangered species. It is huge. It is iconic. It is worshipped and despised. It is beautiful and hideously ugly. It does a wicked mating dance and eats colossal meats. And it's not really dead. The condor is the soul of the wilderness. The condor is smarter than you think. The condor is a rat with 10-foot wings and the enemy of progress. It's a bird whose sad demise and incomplete recovery is a preview of the future facing lions, tigers, bears, and other charismatic species.
The condor population became threatened in part because of poaching and egg collecting. That's been outlawed, but other problems plague them today. That's what KALW's Alyssa Kapnick found out at the Oakland Zoo's Condor Rehabilitation Center.
So we're passing lions right now. And we're coming up on our aviary right here.
Nikki Mora is leading me through the Oakland Zoo. She's the marketing and PR manager here, and she has special access to a hidden part of this animal world.
I don't know how muddy it's going to be down here. We're going to go down this path.
We head behind the zebra exhibit and beyond the elephant barns.
Oh, they have the little sign up. That's kind of cool.
And finally, we've reached our destination. A giant empty cage hidden away from zoo visitors, out of earshot and out of sight.
They put up this mesh right here so that it's kind of a sound barrier and sight barrier outside of the facility so that the birds don't get scared and they're just kind of in their own environment back here.
The cage is about 20 feet square and 10 feet tall, built for the big birds who will eventually land here. This is the newest site of the California Condor Recovery Program. But there aren't any condors here yet.
Obviously, we never want to have them here because that means they're sick.
This is Dr. Andrea Goodnight, the associate veterinarian at the zoo. She's been studying condors for years and feels a personal investment in preserving them.
I can tell you the first time that you see a condor in the wild is just a magical experience.
The way she describes it, when the California condor takes flight, it flaps its wings once and then just rides the wind currents for hours at a time. The birds can fly 150 miles at a stretch and as high as 15,000 feet in the air.
I can recount when I was in Pinnacles National Monument hiking with my husband, and I was condor spotting because I knew that they were supposed to be there, and I kept looking. I'd look up and see a big bird, and we'd both point, oh, no, it's a vulture. Oh, it's another turkey vulture. Oh, it's a turkey vulture. And then you see this thing that makes this big shadow come over, and you point, and it's like, oh, that's a condor. And there's just nothing like it.
It's a beauty humans have long wanted to capture. Museum collectors used to kill condors for their displays. And it's no wonder. The bird is magnificent. A wingspan of nearly 10 feet and a shock of red skin on its skull. Condors were also hunted for food and their eggs stolen by egg collectors. In the first half of the 20th century, the federal government started trying to preserve the birds. But by the early 1980s, there were only about a dozen wild condors left. By this point, scientists had been studying the bird for years. They acted quickly, by literally going out and collecting every single bird they could find, and bringing them to breeding sites at the San Diego Wild Animal Park and the Los Angeles Zoo. They found and captured the last known wild condor, whom they called Igor, on Easter Sunday, 1987.
Luckily, these scientists were able to figure out how to breed the birds in captivity, how to release them, how to get them successfully back out in the wild.
Biologists began releasing the condors just 5 years after they'd collected them all. They've continued to breed them, and now, 2 decades later, there are 226 wild California condors. But the birds still aren't totally out of the woods, so to speak. It's illegal to hunt them now, but hunters are still a danger. The condors are scavengers, which means they don't often kill their own food, but rely on eating animals that have already died.
And so what is happening to the birds now is that they are eating carcasses that they find out in the wild that have been shot by hunters or ranchers or poachers at times as well.
Nowadays, the carcasses the condors eat are often animals that were shot and killed by lead bullets. This means that the meat has lead poisoning. And when the condors eat that meat, they get lead poisoning. Death by lead is slow and painful. Lead-poisoned condors have trouble flying and walking and can't protect themselves. They fall off cliffs or starve to death. The problems become so severe that scientists now go out regularly to test the wild condor's blood levels and take them back for treatment if their levels are high, which brings us back to the Oakland Zoo.
What we do is basically give them a drug that helps pull the blood, lead out of the blood, and then they are able to excrete it through their kidneys.
The process Dr. Goodnight is describing is called chelation, it can take from a week to long months. During that time, the scientists want to make sure that the birds don't get too used to humans, so that they'll be ready for release back into the wild as soon as they're cured. This means taking some extreme measures.
Here you can kind of see there's two holding areas, so we could actually treat two sick condors down here.
This is Nikki Mora again.
I would say each side of the holding facility is probably as large as a small living room or sitting area that one might have in their home.
A sitting area with chain link fence walls and no insulation.
In the wild, the birds would not have a heated environment, so they don't want them to get used to special cozy environments.
When the birds arrive, the scientists and vets will be able to monitor them by video 24 hours a day. The zookeepers want as little contact with the birds as possible, so the zoo has designed some special systems.
There's actually a chute. See that chute right there? That's where they're going to feed the birds.
Moore is pointing to a big black tube sticking out of the cement wall and into the pen. The zookeepers will feed the condors through the chute so that the birds won't think that the food is coming from humans and won't, therefore, become reliant on humans for food. In theory, this will all work perfectly. The condors will get better, they'll be released, and they'll live their lives in the wild. But scientists at other condor rehab centers have already discovered another problem. Once they're released, the birds go right back to finding and eating lead-tainted meat. They're still getting sick. So biologists are trying yet another intervention. Here's Dr. Goodnight again.
The biologists are literally dragging cow carcasses up there, these calves that they get from dairies, stillborn calves. They take them up there. They know that they're non-tainted. They know they don't have any lead in them. And so they supplementally feed the birds. And obviously, this can't continue forever. It's not a self-sustaining population that way.
It's easy to see why scientists thought it was the obvious choice to remove all condors from the wild and bring them in for breeding. Otherwise, they'd disappear forever. It's harder to determine how much and for how long the birds have been changed by human contact. In an open letter from September of 1980, David Brower, founder of the Sierra Club Foundation, wrote the following.
A condor is only 5% feathers, flesh, blood, and bone. The rest is place. Condors are a soaring manifestation of the place that built them and coded their genes. That place requires space to meet in, to teach fledglings to roost unmolested, to bathe and drink in, to find other condors in and not biologists, and to fly over wild and free.
The Oakland Zoo expects to be fully prepared for sick California condors come early spring, but they're definitely not hoping for them. They're hoping the birds stay out in the wild, where they're meant to be. In Oakland, I'm Melissa Kapnick for Cross Currents.
What species are you passionate about, and how are you helping preserve it and its habitat? Share your natural activism with us on Facebook, KALW News. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Oakland's California Condor Rehabilitation Center may still be waiting for birds, but there's another local animal hospital that's got plenty of patients. Loud, several hundred pounds heavy kinds of patients. This is the Marine Mammal Rescue Center in Sausalito, where stranded sea swimmers are treated, rehabilitated, and released. Reporter Lo Benny Shu recently visited the center and brings us this report.
So when I arrive, it's breakfast time at the hospital. The Friday day crew of volunteers waiting for me in the kitchen, and it really smells like fish. Carol Wilson, one of the volunteers, sees the look on my face.
Yeah, whatever clothes you wear here, you can't ever wear anywhere else.
Wilson has volunteered at the center for the last decade.
It's really hands-on. I do amazing things. I give shots to animals. I have taught countless elephant seals how to eat fish or gotten to help do that. I've done, I've gotten to draw blood when animals die.
While she talks, she's also preparing the fish, usually herring, in this huge industrial-looking kitchen. The volunteers take big bricks of frozen fish out of the freezer, thaw them, and sort them out. They sort through the fish to make sure there are no lacerations. The smallest cut could have bacteria in it and could cause harm to the animals. The unwanted fish goes in the grinder. So now breakfast is ready. The fish is carried in metal buckets to the pens. But remember, this is a hospital, and some of these animals do need medication.
There is a medfish. You can tell it's the medfish because the end of the fish is cut off, so we know that that's the medfish, and we also put a little cap on it that had the pills in it, and the pills are stuffed inside. So the we have to make sure that the animal gets that particular fish, and if for some reason it didn't eat it, we would know it didn't because the tail's cut off.
All right.
All right, let's do it.
I'm wearing ugly rubber boots provided by the Marine Mammal Center, and the volunteers are all wearing slickers. They're rubbery fisherman overalls. Also not a fashion statement. We also all have to step in a solution of hydrogen peroxide before going in and out of the pens and from the pen areas to other areas of the center, which has never been a problem for Tamara Thomas, an education volunteer.
So what we're going to do is... we've got our animal here, which is Filano, and he's a California sea lion. And we're going to feed him this morning 1¾ kilograms of fish. So our vets go through each patient's chart, and they put in there how much they're going to get to eat each day. And so we're doing breakfast.
How do they pick the names?
So the person who calls in the rescue, when we see this animal sick, injured, hurt somewhere, they get to name that animal. They get to name that patient.
Some of the animals I saw that day had names like wolverines or bandicoot, but they also have other means of identification.
Everybody's also got a tag on them, and it's an orange tag, and you can see it's on the front flipper, which numbers on it, 27502, which will identify that patient. We'll always stay with that patient, so if he came in again, we would know it was Filano.
So it's one thing to see wolverine and bandicoot from the outside of the pen, but then we open the door.
So we're going to go into the pen right now, and everybody has to have a board to go in to protect themselves.
Should I remain behind the board?
Yeah, you want to always be behind the board.
All right.
Sea lions are really fast, and they have teeth, and they bite.
The wooden boards look like riot shields. They have bite marks all over them.
Okay. And then we're going to go in the pen with our boards.
So now Drew's going to just toss in handfuls of fish.
There are two reasons for throwing fish in the water. One, it distracts the animal from us while we enter the pen. Two, it keeps them sharp. Remember that these animals aren't pets. They're patients, and they'll eventually return to the ocean where they will have to hunt and fish in the water. Here's Jim Oswald, the center's PR manager.
The reason why we rescue these animals is it's a humane response. These animals strand on area beaches and other spots for a reason, either illnesses, in some cases that might be caused by human activities, ocean trash entanglements, gunshot wounds, and other bad things that happen to marine mammals as a result of humans.
But human responsibility aside, the center also does scientific research that directly contributes to human medical science. Some of these animals come with cancers and illnesses that can also affect humans. The algae bloom that are a danger to marine mammals are the same ones that keeps us from eating oysters during certain seasons. And we know that thanks to the research conducted by the Marine Mammal Center. While we're checking out the fish in the kitchen, Jim tells me a bit more about it.
You know, we get California sea lions in particular, suffering from what's called domoic acid poisoning. It's toxic algae, basically. So these animals eat the fish that have eaten that algae, right? But then the animals become sick. But also, it makes them disoriented. So pretty soon you hear about sea lions ending up on highways in the Central Valley, for instance. We'll get rescue calls, you know. We see a sea lion out on I-80, for instance. Yeah.
I've been to a release once. They bring the animal to the beach in a massive dock kennel, open the door, and wait for the animal to go to the water. Surprisingly emotional. Any of the animals swimming up and down the California coast right now might have been patients at the Marion Mammal Center. Just look out for an orange tag.
That piece was produced by Lo Benishu for the Field Trip Podcast. It's a show that takes science out of the lab and into the world, produced by our very own KALW's Casey Miner. Hear more science adventures at fieldtrippodcast.com. Whether it's endangered condors or marine mammal rescues, here on Cross Currents, we hope our stories resonate with you, and we look forward every day to your feedback. Last week, we aired a story produced by KALW's Ben Trefney and Ray Sue Sussman that discussed Golden Gate Park's new biking lanes, and it prompted an unprecedented response.
I cannot tell you how much I hate the new arrangements. I wish they would go back to the old ways. It's really hard not to hit people now as you ride the bike to work.
I'm totally pro bike safety and bike lanes. I find the new stripes to be a huge hazard. Many times when I've been either parking or riding my bike or walking, I see clumps of people, often tourists or people with children or animals that are hard to control. Veering into or grouped in the lane, and if I'm on my bike, especially with my daughter on the back, it's really hard to get out of the way. Or if I'm trying to open my door, it's I'm always worrying about bicyclists.
You know, I ride it for exercise, so I'm not trying to just ride slowly and have a leisurely ride. I'm always at risk of mowing down pedestrians, children, you know, who aren't aware, aren't paying attention to the fact that a bike lane is right next to their parking.
Those are the voices of listeners Ilan Wittenberg, Jillian Nathan, and David Anacarico. And now here's Ben Trefney with a follow-up on that story.
Thanks, Hannah. So as we heard, a lot of people are concerned about the potential for pedestrian bike collisions now that we have a new configuration. And the MTA told me that before they changed the striping, there were no pedestrian bike collisions between 2006 and 2011 when they last have the records of it. We don't have an updated police record of what's happened since the striping has been changed, but that'll be forthcoming. But this piece really did strike a nerve with listeners. It's been shared more than 100 times on Facebook and more than 250 times on Twitter so far. And I'd like to share some of the online comments we've received. One person wrote that the plan doesn't work because the road is just too narrow to accommodate two lanes of traffic, parking, buffer zones, and bike paths. But several people wrote to say they were happy about how traffic is slowed in Golden Gate Park, and a few suggested that cars be banned from the east side of the park every day rather than just on weekends like it is now. I talked with SFMTA spokesperson Paul Rose about the thoughts that our listeners shared. He said they've actually been monitoring that online conversation, and he added this.
Well, there's been a lot of input and feedback on the project, and we've used some of that feedback to make adjustments to the project, including notifying where people cannot park their car on the cycle track. And you know, as we go forward and finalize our report that comes out next month, we may make additional adjustments based on the feedback and input we continue to receive.
We've shared all of your phone messages and online comments with the San Francisco Municipal Transportation Agency. Their full report on the impact of the JFK cycle track is due at the end of next month.
Thanks, Ben. And there's still time for you to share your thoughts on this issue. Leave us a message at 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106, and we'll pass it on. Or you can find a link to the SFMTA's online feedback form at kalw.org. You've been listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. The team includes Julie Kane, Leela Day, Audrey Dilling, Chris Hoff, Alyssa Kapnick, Erica Mu, Liz Pfeffer, Mary Reese, Stephen Short, Eva Solnsen, RJ Sloan, Anna Sterling, and Christine Stolakis. Today's show is engineered by Seth Samuel. Casey Miner is our senior editor. Our managing editor is Martina Castro. Ben Trefney is our executive editor. Holly Kernan is our news director. Thanks to City Car Share, which provides an alternative transportation option for our
supporters. They're online at citycarshare.org. And thank you. We are listener-supported radio. Tune in to Cross Currents tomorrow at 5. We walk in the shoes of a new business owner in the competitive Mission District of San Francisco.
Yes, it's very personal. It's very, very personal. The things happening to this store, I've never been so emotional at work.
Making it work in the Mission. That's tomorrow at 5 on Cross Currents. The music you're listening to is by Dodge's Sun Dodgers. They specialize in updated versions of music that were popular nearly a century ago, like ragtime, ballads, waltzes, and, as you can hear now, Hawaiian steel guitar. They're playing on Saturday night at Cafe Lila on San Pablo in Berkeley. All the details are at klw.org. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.